Welcome to the latest episode of the Net Zero Investor podcast, where we discuss how investors tackle climate change, the biggest issue of the 21st century. My name is Mona Dola, and I'm the editor of Net Zero Investor. So it's peak springtime out here in the UK, and if you, like me, are lucky enough to live near a bit of nature, you'll be enjoying the oak trees gradually turning dark green, and it's really an amazing time of the year. But let's turn from all this peace and harmony to something slightly less prosaic, which is deforestation. And of course, that plays a major role in accelerating climate change and also causes significant social and financial damages. Globally, around 10 million hectares of forests are lost annually, and since the 1990s, more than 400 million hectares have been lost due to deforestation. A lot of this has taken place in the Amazon, and agriculture and the global food industry have been identified as some of the key drivers of deforestation. Most investors probably are well aware of the financial risk caused by environmental destruction, with more than half of the world's GDP dependent on nature. But how do they track down companies that are responsible for deforestation? And what can you as an investor do to engage with them on their practices? Many investors are already monitoring deforestation in their equity portfolios. But today we want to take a closer look at the role of fixed income portfolios and what fixed income investors can do to tackle deforestation risks. With us today, we've got a friend of the show, Joe Richardson. Josephine is head of research at the Anthropocene Fixed Income Institute. And every time she comes back on the podcast, I'll start getting better on pronouncing the name of the organization. So Joe was a speaker at last week's Nature Positive Investment Forum. And thanks for coming back on the podcast, Joe.
No, thank you so much for having me.
So, Joe, just to give our listeners a bit of context, you started looking, the Anthropocene Fixed Income Institute started just looking at climate change broadly, but is increasingly also looking at nature risks, right? So can you tell me a bit more about the idea of tracking deforestation debt and what prompted you to launch this research?
You know, as you've already suggested, we look very hard at the fixed income market in particular. We think a lot of sustainability orientated investors are very focused on the equity side, and we really try and understand what role fixed income financing can play, and then also more importantly, perhaps the role that investors can have in trying to use their decisions and their investment decisions and their engagement to, you know, have better outcomes and improve some of these situations. We began our work on deforestation actually nearly 2 years ago, kind of, you know, looking specifically at which of the core actors or influencers are funding in the fixed income market, you know, and what role could be played in promoting the responsible supply chains. I mean, we've learned quite a lot from our climate work, but in integrating nature loss concerns, I mean, you know, there have been a lot of challenges, and these are, of course, challenges that lots of market participants are facing. And certainly one of the reasons we've started with the focus on deforestation is perhaps it's a little more single dimensional, right? It's kind of one thing and you can focus on it and you can track it. And also, as you said, obviously in your introduction, it's so integral to some of the global food supply chains, global agriculture, you know, and these are big multinational companies who are reliant on the debt market for their financing. So, you know, one maybe first kind of, you know, we certainly looked at it, and, you know, even this exposure identification can be really challenging. And maybe this is one point I just love to highlight first. All of our, you know, our work so far, and we're going to talk about it a little bit more, it is very much focused on this exposure. You know, what are the commodities and the production of which commodities in which regions that are most historically contributory to deforestation, and which companies have those commodities in their supply chain. So, you know, historically what we've seen is deforestation related engagement has been so focused on the high profile names. Everyone can name the two or three companies that they think of that they associate with deforestation. A lot of engagement has been focused there. But until you can have more like a kind of comprehensive assessment, and, you know, you can make statements such as, you know, 10% of my portfolio is exposed to deforestation, or I've been able to reduce my deforestation exposure by 3% in the last year. Until you can actually look at these things from a comprehensive point of view, it can be quite hard to integrate them in everyday decisions. For us, as I said, we focus on this exposure point because we think it's just, you know, it's much more quantitative, it's more comprehensive. We have, of course, used data as available. In fact, we source our data from an organization called Forest IQ, which itself is a sort of consolidation of other data sources that are available, but we think it's very comprehensive and it can be very clear on this kind of boundary of what's exposed and what's not exposed. You know, the first piece of work we did, which underpins a kind of number of follow-up analyses, was to identify the universe, to identify a universe of exposed issuers. That's actually a lot harder than you think. It's easy to identify a universe of fossil exposed issuers. You just look at the fossil fuel companies and the sectors and the energy sector. You know, here it's actually much, much harder than you might think, which is perhaps why this sort of exposure doesn't perhaps attract as much attention as, you know, we maybe feel it should. As said, we've created this universe of 101 issuers. So 101 issuers, all of those are materially exposed to the in-scope commodities. This will include companies with different levels of risk. Some will be, you know, setting stronger targets or promoting more disclosure, but they all have this material level of exposure. And what's interesting is these have collectively issued, one more statistic, nearly $1.3 trillion of debt, right? Now, that is an enormous part of the market. That's an enormous potential pool of investors who can use their investment decisions to engage, to ask questions, to seek better disclosure, you know, and I think that's the starting point, therefore, for our work, which is this universe. And then how do we use it? Just very quickly, we do a lot of case study analyses. We'll talk about a few of those. We do some portfolio level work. I just sort of said, I think from an investor point of view, you do need that top-down analysis, maybe to make decisions. And then we also look at the actual transactions, you know, the syndication fees, which banks are doing the deals, et cetera, to try and shine some light there as well.
Okay, that's really interesting. I mean, just to make this more concrete for our listeners, I mean, you might not be surprised, but the names you see in your research are sort of the likes of Mars, Johnson & Johnson, PepsiCo, McDonald's, Target, Nestle, so big food companies, some cosmetics firms as well, which is quite interesting. But my first question when I read this was obviously looking at the deforestation exposure of some of these companies. They obviously have often a very different narrative. So Mars, for example, would say that its supply chain is free of palm oil and that is contributing to deforestation. I think we have to be quite specific how we phrase it there, because they've obviously been accused of this before and they have a different narrative there. So how do you decide which companies to include and which ones not to include?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. So the universe, you know, is designed to have a very clear inclusion criteria. And as I kind of said before, it's exclusively about exposure. So we know within the universe, there will be companies that are perhaps performing better or being more responsible or perhaps less responsible. And in fact, just talking about Forest IQ again, Forest IQ does provide some metrics potentially related to the risk as well. However, the scores there are based on self-disclosure, which is, of course, one of the challenges in the point. So, you know, a lot of the information in this space is based on self-disclosure. It's very hard to verify. So that's one of the reasons why we focus on exposure. So we've created this universe. And as said, it's really that starting point for asking questions. So you've mentioned Mars, really interesting name. Mars, as listeners may be aware, earlier in the year came to market and issued $26 billion of debt. Now, that is my statistic. I think it's the eighth largest investment grade deal ever. That was enormous, right? And obviously, it issued this bond to fund its acquisition of Kellanova, another name in our universe, in fact, and potentially exposed to deforestation. And what's kind of interesting there is, because it was identified in the universe, because therefore this was a transaction that we felt relevant for deforestation and we wanted to look into more closely, it was a chance to look at the specifics, both of Mars and of Kellanova's commitments. And in fact, we found that Mars was potentially more responsible. It had made more comprehensive commitments. It was disclosing more. It had aligned its deforestation policy with some external standards, which, again, really interesting on a relative basis to see that perhaps Kellanova had not made quite as comprehensive commitment. But what's kind of interesting there, and again, this is now maybe back to, okay, kind of, so what? We've identified opportunities for engagement. You know, what happens next? But because the company was in the market, because it was asking investors for $26 billion, those investors have a real opportunity to engage and ask for things and, you know, potentially set conditions under what kind of terms or what price they will offer money into that deal. And from our point of view, what we were supporting investors to do was require that the standards were applied across the new entity. You know, Mars has some standards. It's acquiring another very significant competitor in the space. This is a chance for it to spread its higher standards and move its higher standards across the full entity. And also, Mars is a private company. So the debt market is the only way to potentially engage as an investor with this organization.
Ah, oh, that's really interesting. I didn't actually know that. Maybe I should have known, but that's interesting.
Mars company, Mars family.
Yeah. A key message to take take home here is that being included in your deforestation research is not necessarily per se a value judgment of that sort of company that's doing badly. It's just that company has exposure to deforestation risk, and then there's different gradients of how well or not well they're doing. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay. And there's another company that stood out to me is PepsiCo, where you said there has been conflicting evidence of deforestation and how it's treated in the supply chain. So what can investors do in these cases of conflicting evidence?
That's another really interesting case study. I mean, so PepsiCo, we would argue, well, on the basis of our forest IQ assessment, is categorically exposed. And again, it's exposed actually through palm oil, soy, and pulp and paper. Like, these commodities are completely intertwined with so many of the supply chains that we see in these multinational consumer companies. You know, what there is potentially conflicting evidence of is the risk and the management. And in the PepsiCo situation specifically, there are some allegations by, I believe, some philanthropic investigations that the company was involved in sourcing palm oil from deforested areas in the Amazon for the past 3 years. Again, that's an allegation, but that is in the public domain, and that is the claim. Now, Pepsi have launched an internal investigation, but so far, the findings of that do not seem to have been made public. Now, I think what's kind of interesting here is actually how timely and relevant and constantly changing the situation is. Like, these are really current dates that we're talking about. The allegations of deforestation is in the last 3 years. The investigation, you know, has been, I think, done but not published. You know, if you're an investor being asked for money in this company, there are really things that you can ask to just improve disclosure and transparency in this situation. And it's that point of issuance, you know, that point of issuance when Pepsi is asking for your money, that as an investor, you have a chance to ask for things.
Another thing I wanted to pick up from your research is that you also look at the role of banks and the syndication fees that they gain from what we could call deforestation bond issuance. So some of these banks also have deforestation policies in place, but often they don't cover the whole part of the value chain. Can you tell us a bit more about the problems with that?
No, absolutely. I mean, so as you said, we do also focus on banks. I mean, when looking at maybe the role or the structure of the fixed income market, one of the things that's so potentially kind of an opportunity for engagement or maybe separate to other markets is that it's kind of constantly turning over in this primary market process where companies say, come back to the market and say, I'd like to borrow your money again, is happening just all the time. And then a really important part of that is the role of the banks. So the banks, who are sometimes called the syndicators or the underwriters, you know, what's their role? They will provide advice to the borrower and ultimately then go out and will borrow the money, will facilitate that capital market access. Oh, I want to borrow $1 billion. Fantastic. I'm a bank. I will call my clients and I will find people to buy your bonds and implicitly lend you $1 billion. And it's a real kind of matching up facilitation role. And this is a fee based. This is a really important business for banks. It's both a very profitable business, being it's fee-based, and I think we estimate it to be around 1-3% of revenue for large investment banks. But it's also a really important introductory business. You know, when you look at how these banks work with their large clients, you know, this underpins ongoing trading relationships, ongoing advisory services. Like, this shows that you're supporting in the market the company and the company's business. And this syndication activity, this fee-based business, you know, we feel can sometimes fall between the cracks in terms of oversight. You know, bank policy, commitments, they often rely on balance sheet activities like direct lending. You know, who do I actually lend my money as a bank to, you know, rather than this fee. But the importance of this banking relationship, this importance of a company to be able to access capital markets, we really think is crucial. So we look at the syndication fees. We look at which banks have earned the most fees from transactions which are related to our in-scope issuers. And then, of course, we've analysed the deforestation policies of the bank in question to kind of see if that might be consistent or not. And, you know, you've honed in on a really interesting point, which is this one about which part of the value chain is covered. So maybe just to step back another point, you know, as in, we cover the large debt issuers. In fact, the threshold for inclusion in our deforestation debt universe is that you have $2.5 billion of debt outstanding. So, you know, that means these are large companies. They're typically at the end of the supply chain. They're retailers, commodity traders, they're these multinational consumer production companies, you know, often several steps away from any direct deforestation. And in this way, like, the boundaries of the value chain can be really relevant. I mean, I would argue the full value chain is responsible for any deforestation. But, you know, some people will take a view that if you're not cutting down the trees yourself, you're not involved in that activity. And so we looked specifically in this piece of work at the palm oil policies of some of the banks who generated the most fees. Again, one challenge is it's often a different policy for a different commodity. But, you know, we're trying to at least have an exercise in understanding. So we looked at the palm oil policies. What was really interesting was we saw a variety of applicability across the value chains. You know, for example, our interpretation of the policy from Citibank actually covered the whole value chain. Whereas, you know, we interpreted the policy from JP Morgan and BNP, it did not include the downstream. It did include the downstream value chain, i.e. perhaps the commodity traders who are still dealing with the specific commodities, but it potentially didn't include the next step in the chain where the commodity was transformed into a different product. Based on this analysis, in fact, it was Mizuho where we believe the policy was restricted only to the upstream production. With this piece of work, I'm just trying to highlight that there are some real kind of nuances. And unfortunately, that means an investor may have to do like a bit more work to really understand what's going on. You know, and we would hope to, one of the things you can support for there is standardization of policies.
So investors that want to engage with the banks on that question basically should be pressing them to include tackle deforestation risk across the whole of the supply chain. That's the specific suggestion here.
I mean, here, certainly, you know, as said, to really cover the scope of all of these companies, it needs to cover the full value chain. But actually then going a step further, like what do we, you know, support or want investors to even do with this kind of data? We actually use these sorts of things to support almost responsible procurement. Right. How can investors, you know, have the right influence to support the change they need? You know, going to a bank and saying, please have this policy, you know, what influence does that have? What lever can you have to actually support the behavior change that you want to see? And we use these league tables that we produce to support, as I said, this sort of responsible procurement, i.e., you know, investors make all sorts of decisions about banks all the time. You know, who should I trade with? Who should I do my prime brokerage with? Who should I have this custody arrangement with? And all of the, you know, this concept of responsible procurement, oh, I'm going to buy fair trade coffee. Or maybe I'm only going to trade with a bank who has a really responsible deforestation policy because that's aligned with my values. You know, so we actually use these to specifically try and support investors in using them for their counterparty selection, right? Very much. And I'm a responsible investor and I only want to deal with banks who are aligned to my values. And what I define as being aligned to my values is, I don't know, a policy that covers the full value chain for deforestation or something. But what's interesting about that as a kind of role of engagement is also you can now imagine these really interesting conversations within banks because of their deforestation policy. You know, you might have the head of trading who suddenly had a tough conversation with a client, you know, the head of debt capital markets who's deciding what bank, what bonds to issue, you know, the head of sustainability. And suddenly you've got all of these different business areas within a bank making a decision about how to think about deforestation to maintain relationships with their key clients.
That's really interesting and shows the potential power of fixed income markets and hopefully turning some things around. So let's go back to the consumer goods companies with deforestation exposures. So you highlight a couple of them and you mentioned there's the importance of the refinancing cycle. So when their old debt is maturing and they're potentially going out to the market to refinance, that's obviously the right point to engage with them, right? So some of them are Amazon, Shell and GSK that have debt that is maturing because the refinancing is a bit tricky, right? It's harder to see who's issuing new debt, but when the debt is expiring, it's pretty clear. So what can investors do with that kind of information?
You know, exactly as you say, like, you know, our big takeaway is to try and advocate for the power of the fixed income market. And this really goes back to our core theory of change. You know, we're focused on public fixed income markets as a lever of influence. And that opportunity is very related to the primary market process. I say all the time, corporate bonds are refinanced on average every 5 years. And it's that point when a borrower comes back to market and asks investors for money again, you know, that is the point of influence. Investors can make, you know, in principle, any kind of financing, conditional on improved disclosure, improved targets, improved behavior, you know, sort of whatever you want to do. Now, drilling in a bit more on this primary market process, you know, which is when a company is kind of publicly saying, you know, I would like to borrow $1 billion, you know, I would like to issue $1 billion of bond. The process is often really fast. You know, that's a very sensitive piece of information that a company is trying to borrow so much money. And deals can often be announced and executed in a single day. And in that day, I'm not quite saying it's too late, but, you know, what can really be done in such a tight time profile can be a bit more limited. So to the any extent that that can be anticipated gives a greater opportunity for market participants to engage and discuss the required improvements. I mean, in truth, discussions are happening between issuers and investors all the time. And certainly if one was able to anticipate a month or 2 months before a bond was coming, the power of that investor saying, well, I would need these various conditions, you know, to refinance your bond would be really powerful. So we, in this paper that we've just published, looked at the bonds that were maturing, because of course that can be one indicator that a new bond will be issued. We actually, dare I now highlight another tool on our website, which we call the Bond Horizon Tracker. We actually have developed also, you know, in many ways, a more substantive model to predict bond issuance, which is, again, live on our website. And it shows the kind of companies that our model suggests are most likely to be in the market in the next 3 months. You know, it looks at both maturing of debt, which is, you know, obviously a key point at which new debt might need to be issued. It also looks at kind of news stories. So, for example, in, say, the Mars Kalanova situation we talked about earlier, Mars was making a very large acquisition, and that can be an indicator of needing to issue bonds. It also looks at the kind of pricing of bonds, because companies often come and issue bonds when their bonds are trading quite tight because they can get more attractive pricing. So, you know, we do put a lot of effort into across sectors, but also specifically for our deforestation universe, we do put quite a lot of effort into trying to predict the companies that are going to come back to market next, so that, you know, investor engagement, which is of course hard and timely, can be really focused on those companies who are going to be in the market next.
That is really fascinating. I must honestly say I had no idea how fast moving the whole process is with issuance in primary markets. It's like in any negotiation, it helps if you come in prepared, right? If you're just being overwhelmed by it, then you're unlikely to get a good deal. That's really interesting. So to wrap all this up, what are you hoping to achieve by tracking deforestation debt issuance and refinancing cycles over time?
So, you know, specifically in deforestation, I think we're just trying to raise the profile of deforestation as an issue. You know, it's very easy to think it only affects a few companies in a few countries. And in fact, you know, the commodities creating deforestation are integral to the supply chain of some really big companies that you haven't heard of. So for deforestation, we really just want people to think about it more and realize that it is kind of everywhere around us. But over and over, and again, Mona, we've talked about this before, but I love a chance to say it again, I want to support fixed income investors in being more ambitious for the potential impact they can have with those investments.
Yeah, I love that whole theory. It just goes back to the whole concept of net zero investor and kind of following the money to drive change on climate change. I think bond markets are so important, and we can't talk about it often enough, really. But yeah, sadly, we're coming to the end of our podcast, and I hope this has really helped our listeners shed some light onto the conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jo.
Thank you, Mona, for having me.
It's been great fun discussing this again. Now, if you enjoyed listening to this podcast and you wanted to hear more about this in person, our next in-person event is on the 12th of June. We've got a Charities and Endowments Summit coming up in London. Then on the 16th of September, we've got Net Zero Investor Real Estate, another summit. And on the 21st of October, of course, make sure not to miss our annual conference, which is also in London. So I hope I'll see some of you at either of these events. Thanks very much for listening in.